We're talking with Josh Reeves from theglobalreality.com. We have been primarily talking about the CNP, the fake right wing, controlled opposition and infiltration, if you will, of the alternative media. And we're kind of on a trail here and we're going to continue to follow it. And I want to continue to talk more about the Jesuits, the Sovereign Order of the Knights of Malta, and the priest clash that you class that you mentioned before, Josh. We hear, as you mentioned before, that there's a struggle between Freemasonry and Jesuits or the Catholic world, that as a Catholic you can't join Freemasonry. The Knights of Columbus seems to be an exception in some regards. They are Catholic, but they both have a keen interest in Freemasonry. There's other examples like Cardinal Francis Spellman, Archbishop Edward Egan, and it's been even speculated that Tony Blair was actually a member of the Studholme Lodge in England, and he obviously converted to Catholicism after that. So this is not quite true. There seems to be a real gray area here, and where this really meets seems to be when you actually look into the world of the Knights Templar, since they exist both in the Freemasonic world and the Catholic world as well. What do you make of this, Josh, in terms of the fact that if you go high up enough in the Freemasonic world or in the Catholic orders, if you will, they seem to kind of converge there. And we actually had a confirmation, if you will, of that with one of our guests that we had with us back in 2008, William F. Mann. He was a head of the Canadian Knights Templar. So what's going on there, Josh? What do you make of it?
Well, that's one of the things that I have found absolutely is that all this stuff about these groups being separate or one group not being involved with the other group is an absolute lie, and it's just something that's been put out there into the eyes of the public so that we don't really see how much power the greater agenda has. For example, going back to the origins of the Council for National Policy, this is to me where you really see a great example of that, Henrik. And The group was started, as I mentioned in the last hour, in 1981. It was started by the Reverend Tim LaHaye, who many people will recognize for his books series called "The Left Behind," which talks about the rapture and all this stuff. And there's a great article that was printed some years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so, in Rolling Stone magazine called "Reverend Doomsday." And people out there can Google that. You can type "Reverend Doomsday." Tim LaHaye, Rolling Stone magazine, into Google, and they can find that and read this for themselves. But it talks about in that interview how when Tim LaHaye, Reverend Tim LaHaye, started, he started with the John Birch Society in 1959. And in 1959, Henrik, Tim LaHaye was talking about things like the UN takeover. He was talking about things like the Illuminati. Many of the key tenets of the research community he was talking about in the late 50s in the John Birch Society. And then you fast forward to that being the same area that happened to launch the Reagan campaign years later. And in 1981, when he formed the Council for National Policy, Tim LaHaye, who has been very, through the years, very open in the media and in the public about the evils of Catholicism and how bad Catholics are and being against them. But yet he takes his startup money for the Council for National Policy from the Hunt family that are based here in Dallas, Texas, who are all Knights of Malta and who are one of the biggest Catholic families in the whole power structure. They breed horses with the Queen of England. And that was one of the initial things for me. I started going, okay, this doesn't make any sense at all. How is it that we have a person who's been vehemently anti-Catholic in the press taking his startup money from this group from Catholics? And then also, he, as I point out in Secret Right Volume 1, he has a book called The Power of the Cross that came out in 1999, Tim LaHaye. And on the cover of this book, you see the crown and the cross. Now, the crown and the cross is a Masonic symbol that goes back thousands of years. It goes back to the York Rite of Freemasonry. And here on the cover of this book, you see this free Masonic symbol. And we also find out Tim LaHaye is also a 32nd degree Freemason. And so right there, you start to see these conflicts and this idea of how can there be Freemasons and Knights of Malta and the Jesuit Order and all these guys existing in this one group? And as you mentioned with the Templars, that's really to me what I found. The Templars excavated Solomon's Temple for all of these ancient magical secrets, and they allegedly found all these ancient manuscripts, the Goetia, all of these various magical texts that, for all intents and purposes, they were using to establish their dominance and power throughout Europe. They set up the first fractional reserve credit enslavement system.
That's right.
They were getting ready, really ready to challenge all of Europe until, of course, you know, as the story goes, the Vatican came along and basically, you know, said they were heretics and, you know, all, basically put them on trial and killed them all. But what people forget about that is that what information didn't get taken up to Edinburgh, Scotland, where they fled to, was absorbed into the Vatican, into the Catholic order. And this is what they've done. They've gone along just absorbing religions throughout the world. They absorb Judaism. They absorb Christianity. They absorb Islam. And that's really what the whole priest class thing is that relates to the Jesuit order and the Vatican. It's this idea that they have absorbed all the world's religions. They've absorbed all the information of the secret societies, and they've molded it into their own thing. I for years, was struggling to find anything in Freemasonry that said, because you're always heard, oh, Freemasonry is satanic, devil worship, it's all this,
right.
It's all pure evil. And in my research, what I found is that it's not the information itself that is evil. It's the hands of the people who are, it's whoever it's in the hands of that are using it. So
that's
the
right.
priest class created this environment to where anybody who's lived over the past 300-400 years will not know any different, that information, that knowledge only exists in the hands of people that have established themselves as working for the greater power structure. And so I think that that's why finding out about this information, looking into these deeper esoteric teachings, looking into this Masonic stuff, I think it's vitally important that all of us out there who call ourselves researchers are looking at that, because I think that that could be the Achilles heel. That could be what could turn this whole thing around, is us figuring out how we use this information, this knowledge, not for the enslavement or for evil or to use it against humans, but to use it to our greater advantage. And this is talked about in ancient Sumerian texts by Ea or Enki. Enki was said to have set up the first secret society known as the Brotherhood of the Snake. And this is how he wanted to teach mankind in secret who we are, what we are, and where we come from. And that's what I believe to this day, the whole intelligentsia of the Truth Movement, the Patriot Movement, and the CMP that are connected to that priest class, I believe that's what their job is. Their job is to keep us from ever finding out these secrets of the secret society so that we can use them for good and not for evil. I think that's really what they're trying to cover up.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very obvious in that sense. We understand that they obviously have to keep this information secret for it to work for them alone. If people get savvy to this and understand how some of these tricks happen in terms of both those of an occult nature, but also those that are on a kind of a unconscious level and how they operate certain things. And that's why I think so many of these people also so vehemently, these so-called, you know, Christian, in most cases, they also claim that they represent some kind of Protestantism. And I don't know if that's true. I mean, obviously, if this leads back to Catholicism, it could be argued that these actually, again, we're back to the controlled opposition situation. But in any regard, what I'm getting to is that from a lot of these people that we mentioned before from CMP, we hear that all of this stuff about, you know, astrology or looking into esoteric, matters, that's all of the occult, evil, wickedness yep. that we should leave alone. And by golly, you know, don't go there, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. And I that was my whole thing, is I set out to try and disprove that. I found that what's interesting about how the Knights of Malta took hold of the United States, and this ties into the CMP as well, is that after World War II, you started to see they needed a new enemy, and Protestantism had sort of been the enemy of the priest class up to that point. And according to researchers like William Bramley in his book The Gods of Eden, it talks about Protestantism being set up as another one of these maverick religions, one of these religions that was set up, as you mentioned, to be against the power structure at first, but then was again corrupted and turned into just another control mechanism.
I think, sorry to cut you off, Josh, but I personally, from what I've been reading and studying currently, what I have, the feeling of, the sense that I have, is that it was set up from the beginning to be the controlled opposition, if you know what I mean. It's like it's like a really scaled down version. Catholicism, in that sense, represents, at least, if you will, then a religion that carries something with it from the ancient world. And we hear these stories, obviously, when Luther went to Rome to see some of the statues they had there, all the saints that they have. He understood clearly and rightly so that this is, my God, this is based on old, you know, pagan worship from their point of view. And again, that doesn't mean evil or anything like that. But in any regard, he saw that was the case. He understood that. and therefore set up this alternative religion, if you will, then, or started to protest, obviously, against this. But it's a very even more so slimmed down version. For what I'm beginning to see is that this was the agenda, if you will, all along. It's just that for Catholicism to work, is they have to bring something in from the ancient world. So they have kind of like that as a stepping stone. The next step is that is to even take away those things, if you will, from the ancient world. And if we look at it, there's very few expressions, if you will, in a Protestant church as compared to a Catholic church. And nothing of this means that I favor one or the other. I'm just trying to figure out the mechanism that they've been using in order to kind of scale down all the time, Josh. But go ahead before, well, you know.
I think it's the same thing, Henrik, as stuff like the Rothschilds funding every side of every war since the first American Civil War. You know, regardless of who wins or loses, they come out the winners because they're funding both sides. I think that's the same exact thing that you're talking about here, is meaning that if you're going to create a holy war, you're going to create... and it does seem that since time immemorial, going back to the very first societies, that the elite or the priest class or whoever it may be, the power structure itself, has done everything in their power to try and pit us, the individual citizens, against each other. And
that's,
I think,
right.
You're exactly right. That's what the creation of Protestantism or any of these other religions, you have to have an A team and a B team. You have to have a good guy, an alleged good guy, an alleged bad guy.
Yes.
And then what ends up happening? Who ends up fighting those wars and dying for those ideologies? Us, the people. And so a very interesting example of that, tying back into the CMP stuff for me, was when, and I cover this in The Secret Right Volume 1, was how, you know, you had the whole thing where Alex Jones allegedly snuck into the Bohemian Grove and all this stuff and all this information that was coming out. And I wanted to know why there were two big things that were left out. Number one, the owl. We're told that the owl is some representation of Moloch or something like that,
no.
Which is completely untrue.
Yeah,
it's completely untrue. Actually, what the owl represents Minerva, the
right.
Roman god.
That's the true Illuminati symbol, if you want to be adamant about it. They used the owl all the time as a representation of wisdom, one who can see in the dark. But go ahead, Josh.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And so that, to me, that was one glaring example. And then, you know, if one was enough, then there's a number two. And I was saying, okay, well, how come this is never mentioned? Inside the Bohemian Grove, there is a statue of St. John of Nepomuk. Now, if you look up who St. John of Nepomuk was, he was a Jesuit martyr who was martyred because he would not give up. He was killed because he would not give up the secrets of the Jesuits. And of the priest class order. And inside, I think he may even be ushering like a finger over his mouth, you know, saying, shh, keep quiet. But
so
that's what that represents.
So he's a higher Mabif, if you will, from the
yes.
a representation, same way he's an idol that keeping the secret safe, so to speak.
Yes, he's an incarnation of Hiram Mabif, exactly. That's inside of Bohemian Grove. That was left out in Jones' film about that. Those two connections right there with Minerva and St. John of Nepomuk being inside Bohemian Grove, to me, tell the much larger story and tell us why exactly it is that they are there in that grove doing those rituals and what it really goes back to. And to me, if you don't have that information that's left out of the greater picture, it's going to be a lot harder for you to draw your conclusions on what you believe this stuff really is and what these guys are really into.
Absolutely, because again, we always and constantly hear that these people are not Christians. And again, I wouldn't argue that that's not true in the sense that we... in terms of how certain doctrines within Christianity are, practiced, if you will. But at the same time, there's an esoteric version of Christianity too. There's a lot of, difference, as you mentioned, different secrets within these orders and so forth as well, that we, out on the surface, the people know nothing about, and they never have, ever since the time that the church moved into many other countries as well. So they've always, as you said, had this little elite inner circle, a club, a priest class, if you will, and they use any means necessary. To them, I don't think that anything of this is considered to be evil. These are just tools to further enslave the rest of the human race, actually.
That's exactly what it is, and that's the only way they see it. You know, they don't, these guys are not sitting around twiddling their thumbs, you know, like, oh, I'm so evil, ha ha ha. You know, it's not that way for them. It's just that it's been going on for so long, and a lot of these traditions and practices and rites and ideologies are being passed down generationally, and in many cases, a lot of this stuff is being passed down hereditarily through the bloodlines, and now we start to see why that is. That's been one of the more fascinating things for me is going back and seeing just how these different groups, specifically in the right wing, all tend to have these connections back to the bloodlines and what have you, and it's all there. But yeah, I mean, I cannot believe it's just for me, from starting my show in 2007 till now, the amount of information, Henrik, that's out there that you know, I didn't know about when I first started on air, and I thought I knew, you know, pretty much everything at the time. It's just amazing how much information there is out there and how much more there is to know. And again, what bothers me the most is that there just seems to be some dogmatic approach to not, you know, trying to get certain people to not look into certain types of information. I just think that's dangerous.
Absolutely. We hear, you know, quite a bit as well about the connections between Knights in Malta and Blackwater and things like this. Very, very interesting connections connected through, is his name Eric Schmidt? He was the former, was he the head of the Pentagon? And then he moved on to actually work for Blackwater, and he's a member of Knights of Malta. Yeah. And it's quite interesting when you begin to look into some of these connections, Josh.
Yeah, Eric Prince as well. Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater, his father and mother, Edgar and Elsa Prince, were on the board of directors at the inception of the Council for National Policy. And, you know, it just so happens they're both Knights of Malta as well. And his mother was a Dame of Malta. And much like Phyllis Schlafly, she's also a Dame of Malta. And we started to see this, you know, these connections with the father and mother of Eric Prince of Blackwater in the CMP, and then fast forwarding to seeing things like, you know, the Blackwater calling some of their tanks and their Humvees. They had one that was called the Templar One, the Templar Two. They had a tank that was called the Crusader. You know, you start to see these things and you start to understand, okay, well, we see they're connected to these groups like the CMP. We see they're connected to the Knights of Malta and the priest class, but what is the whole... what is their agenda? Why are they committing all of this genocide and bloodshed against Arab populations in the Middle East? And what I believe is that it's a systematic eradication of people who are bloodline descendants of either the Anunnaki or the Nephilim, whoever it was. And these people have some sort of claim to power over the lands of the Middle East where all the oil is. And if you systematically eradicate those people and use depleted uranium and everything else, which affects you know, coming generations, then you can effectively knock that out and keep anybody from ever having a challenge to your power structure. I think that's why they invaded the Iraq National Museum in 2003. At the beginning of the invasion, they took all of the ancient Sumerian seals and the little small reptilian clay statues. Those things disappeared. They found a room full of these. There's footage of this, Henrik, where they actually show, it was on the BBC, where they show our special forces actually breaking open the vault. And when they go inside of the vault, inside of this gigantic vault, there are genie bottles or gin bottles as far as the eye can see. And if you look into that and understand that, those are said to be spirits. And so my question is if they went in there and broke and took all those antiquities, where did all these genie bottles that allegedly had these spirits in them? And, you know, I'm wondering if these guys have unleashed them, if that's what their plan was. But it just continues to be more and more information that we see that for some reason, whatever is in these ancient texts going back to the ancient civilizations of, the Ubaid period of Sumeria, which is pre-Sumeria there in Mesopotamia, then, of course, Sumeria, Babylon, Assyria, we start to see all these correlations to direct connection with the quote-unquote gods or the extraterrestrials and access to this information. You know, I think that's why they've been snapping up these antiquities over the past several years, is because, you know, if 50 years ago, Henrik, if we read an ancient text or an ancient Sumerian text 50 or 60 years ago, and it was referencing genetic manipulation and all this advanced technology, we would think it was hogwash and we wouldn't have any reference point for that. But now that our own technology has progressed and people are going back and looking at these ancient manuscripts, people now have a context for what they're talking about more than any other time in human history. Because now our technology has reached this certain level where now we can go, oh my goodness, they're talking about genetic manipulation here. They're talking about, you know, cutting the top off of a mountain with a laser beam, much as we have seen that happen in Peru near the Nazca lines. That's talked about in the Lost Book of Enki. So we start to, I think that's been why there's been such a power grab and an importance on these antiquities placed on them by the elite, is that now mankind has the ability to reference these texts and know what they're talking about. And I think that's become a serious problem for the elite.
The U.S. are paying for the rebuilding, obviously, of Babylon. They have no intention of leaving whatsoever. America is being bankrupt, leading the role, you know, of wars in Iraq, Afghanistan. And obviously now we see it, you know, going into Libya as well. We see it in Egypt. There's, you know, speculation that this might be, obviously, it is in many other countries as well that I left unmentioned here, but Yemen, Bahrain, possibly Syria, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
What is going on there, do you think? What is it just the reemergence of a new crusade? Or again, does this, is it a rebuilding of something? What the heck is happening here, do you think?
I think it's kind of all of those things, Henrik. I think from what I found, it definitely, the whole thing of them rebuilding, because if you read those ancient texts, the Bible and all these different texts, they talk about how, you know, for the fulfillment of the prophecy that Babylon not only had to be built, but Babylon had to be destroyed. And well, you know, Babylon was never technically destroyed. And so what I believe is that they're trying to rebuild it so they can later destroy it and tear it down to fulfill their prophecy. And you mentioned Yemen, and we've seen a lot of information coming out of there that may indicate that, you know, there are things like the Ark of the Covenant there. You've had Gary Vee,
the Temple of the Queen of Sheba, very interesting.
You've had Gary Vee on the program talking about that here on Red Ice, and it's very interesting stuff because the tribal people of Yemen have been trained generationally for thousands of years to protect that palace and protect what is there. But then we're told in the United States media and in the media throughout the world that there's 8-year-old children in Yemen who have, you know, Smurf stickers on AK-47s and they're trained, but we're never given the context as to why that is. It's not that they're just crazy, militant Al Qaeda children running around with AK-47s. They've been trained generationally to protect and keep what is there, and I think that's exactly what it is. I think that they have now, through using earth-penetrating tomography, using things like HARP to be able to look under deep under the ground to locate resources. I think they've also been able to now locate areas where ancient antiquities are located, and it just so happens that these happen to be in areas of throughout the world where major biblical events happen, major religious events happen, spiritual events happen. And I think that they're in a mad dash to acquire, the Ark of the Covenant, the Tablets of Destiny, all these different things.
Yep.
Because I think that we're reaching a time where I think it's a timeline. I think that I don't have all this put together yet, Henrik, so I don't really know for sure. But what I believe is that I think that there's some sort of a timeline for them to acquire these ancient artifacts and technology. And if they don't, before a certain time period, these things are going to reveal themselves to everyone on the planet, and then it's going to be they're going to be unable to basically use that stuff to control us anymore because, again, you know, the genie will be out of the bottle at that point and all will be revealed. So I think that's why there's been such a mad rush to claim all these countries and different places where artifacts are. It just happens to be the current hotspot of Al-Qaeda. Every time they locate some new antiquities, we're pretty much told not too long after that just happens to be where Al-Qaeda is. So you're starting to see these patterns. I think that pretty much explains it.
Absolutely. And how do you think it is that they can keep an agenda like this going again? I always like to come back to this question again. If it's human beings within these groups and doing this, do you think that they are just there for the sake of the money, for the fact of being in the circle of power for a little while, and this is enough for them? But if we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, we're talking about an agenda that is unfolding throughout thousands of years, and many of these people will never see the whole true fulfillment, if you will, of the plan. So why do they keep supporting this, do you think? And as a top to that, or furtherance to that question, is it possible, do you think, that we have other types of beings with us in this case that actually are capable of living longer in one way or another, meaning that they are actually seeing the fulfillment of the agenda over the long period, the timeline, if you will, Josh?
I think it's very possible. I mean, we've had reports of, the Count of Saint Germain appearing in Mount Shasta in California, you know, years after he was dead, talking about, underground bases and talking about, being immortals. I think that's definitely very real. But I think the reason why, as you mentioned, your question about why do these would continue to push this forward and whatnot, I think for a lot of people, most of the ones that are in this at the highest levels, that's where, again, the whole bloodline thing ties in. What they're told, I think, at a very young age, when they start bringing them up the ranks through high school and into college, and then, as you mentioned, groups like the Skull and Bones at Yale and other groups like that, I think what it is that they're instilling in these people at a very early age this whole idea of family pride. You know, it sounds silly, but I think that's how they get most of these people into doing this, is they essentially say, look, you know, you come from a family that has been in the power structure for thousands of years. I mean, for instance, the Bushes, you can trace the Bushes all the way back to Ramses II if you go far enough in the genealogical records. Mm-hmm. And I think that for a lot of these people, that's what it is. They're told, you know, look, you are very powerful. You come from a very important, powerful family. You are one of these bloodlines. You know, everything you do is important. So I think that when they operate under that, that's what allows them to not really see the evil and the bad of what they're doing, because they believe that they are living up to their birthright by furthering this agenda and by continuing and passing it down to their children and their children after them. That's how they get a lot of these people. And I think some of them, as you mentioned, some of them are very aware of the power structure and aware of the larger agenda, but many are not. And, as far as the whole thing with, different intelligences and communicating with these spirits and different entities and even reptilians and stuff like that, I can tell you all those things. When I first started researching this stuff, Henrik, I was, you know, totally, oh, there's no way any of that stuff. But, you know, I've experienced things and I've seen things where, I mean, for instance, this is a great example. We talked about the CMP. One of their members is a guy by the name of Tom DeLay, former House Majority Leader here in the United States, involved in many scandals. He was involved in the stuff with Jack Abramoff and all the lobbying going on in the right. United States government. Well, I had an opportunity to approach Mr. DeLay back in 2007, and he was coming to do a book signing in Dallas, and my sister and I had went down to, you know, maybe confront the guy or whatever, but we kind of, when it happened, we're kind of like, let's not kind of jump in his face. But I had on a t-shirt that said, what happened to World Trade Center Building 7? And my sister had on a t-shirt that said controlled demolition. And Tom DeLay walked up in the parking lot and he said, how are you guys doing? He looks down at her shirt, looks at my shirt, turns blood red. And then he looks at us and his eyes rolled over black. And he just like looked at us and appeared to scan us up and down. Now, I had heard stuff about the reptilian stuff from people like David Icke and others. And I always said it was just a bunch of hogwash, nothing to it. And then I heard this story, David Icke tell this story about being backstage at a BBC interview and the former Prime Minister of England being there. Yeah, Tom Heath doing that to him. And I went, oh, my goodness. Right. I maybe there was something to this, because there was no doubt, Henry. It was like he looked through us. I felt like he looked through. I felt like I was looking at an entity from somewhere else. Like I wasn't looking at a man. And I'll tell you, you know, it's one thing to see this stuff and go, it may be real or maybe not be real. But, man, it's totally different when you experience it for yourself and you go, oh, my goodness, there's something dark and evil there. So my research has taken me into looking into things like the ancient text of the Goetia, which is a magical text for summoning demons and controlling them, and angels as well, that goes back to the time of King Solomon. I look at stuff like John Dee channeling these entities, channeling these macrobes and different things. And then you, of course, you coincide that with our modern day people who are involved in the Council for National Policy and the right wing, and they're involved at the highest levels of the priest class and religion. And you start to see, oh, these guys are the modern day versions of this. You know, they're taking their marching orders from these off earth entities, these fourth dimensional entities, just as much as people in the past were. But the thing is, we just don't see or can comprehend that that's happening. It's very easy for people to believe that, okay, the Knights Templar were channeling Baphomets and channeling, you know, entities through decapitated heads. And people see that and they go, oh, you know what? They probably were doing that. But then you tell them that, Tom DeLay or somebody like that is doing that, or some of the modern day, and they just don't want to see it. But this stuff has just been passed down continually. And I think that's another element of the whole communicating with off-earth entities, taking their marching orders from that. As I've gone up, I kept going up the power structure, Henrik. I kept researching and going up and up and up. And, you know, I found the Bilderberg Group. I found the Rothschilds. And it just seemed like there was more there to me. And then, I came across, I think it was Michael Desarin who pointed out to me that in the Encyclopedia Judaica, they make reference to the Rothschilds being the guardians of the Vatican's treasury.
Yep.
And that was a huge thing for me. I went, oh, my goodness. You see, now I get what's going on here, is that, you go up and up and up, and you think you found the tip top of the pyramid. You know, the groups get smaller. You go from the CFR to the CMP to the Order of the Garter to the Council of 13, you know, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then you kind of hit a brick wall. You say, well, wait a second here. Now, I can't find any more groups, you know, on the earthly planes, so to speak. I can't find any more groups higher than the bankers or the, you know, the Jesuits or the priest class or whatever else. But there still seems to be another layer of control there that's intangible that we can't touch and we can't see and we can't define and put our hands on. And I think that's where this whole idea of the elite and of the people at the upper echelons channeling entities for information and getting information that they can use for their benefit and for their power. I think that's where that whole thing comes in at. So, you know, it's one of those things where, again, people just have to look into any of this stuff for themselves and judge for themselves. And all I can do and all you can do, Henrik, is kind of relate how we see this stuff from our research. But, you know, it's definitely there.
Absolutely. There seems to be a lot of families that are kind of the stewards or the keepers of the finances, if you will. We have a version of that here in Sweden, the Wallenberg family, very, very wealthy family. And same thing there. It seems to be, it's not that they're not living, obviously, you know, extravagant lifestyles and all that, but there seems to be something else going on there as well. It seems like they're just building and building the wealth, like for something or for somebody. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is the way to do it. Obviously, people, these are usually families that are not in the limelight. So from a person who's coming into this for the first time, they think they might have discovered the ultimate secret once they stumble over, you know, the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds, if you will. But the fact is that there is more to it behind the scenes than that. So obviously they might just be in that position where they're keeping the control of the finances for somebody else. There's another thing I want to wing by you as well. A vital, obviously, component of the inner circle of the elite seems to be the importance, if you will, of joining any kind of secret society. Ritual and initiation into a certain secret society seems to be important. And I've kind of speculated that what if this is a form of mind control, or maybe even more advanced. It could be worse if you look at it from that point of view. It could be some kind of invitation to some of these entities that you mentioned, Josh, to kind of come in and take over the body. I've heard accounts from people who, like, they don't really truly understand the rituals that they go through, but yet they do it, and they pledge allegiance to an organization before they even truly understand what actually the allegiance is and what actually the role in this is. And that's just incredible to me. What do you make of that, Josh?
I think you're absolutely 100% correct as far as I'm concerned from what I found in my research. I started noticing that I ordered this off eBay 4 or 5 years ago. I found a copy of it was a second edition copy of Albert Pike's book Morals and Dogma, which of course is the great Scottish Rite Freemasonry book that they used to take them through all the degrees past the third degree. And I started noticing, as you know, because I just picked the thing up and started reading it, even though that's not technically what you're supposed to do. And I had a friend who actually started reading some of this stuff on his radio show. And as he was reading this stuff on his radio show, his his monitor started flickering, going out. He felt like he was being psychically attacked. All kinds of weird stuff started happening. And that's when I was reading those texts out of Morals and Dogma, it dawned on me that the phrasing of the words, the way that they are written, it's like you read it and you go, wait a minute, grammatically, a lot of this stuff doesn't really make a lot of sense. That's because you realize that each word and each phrase and each sentence in Morals and Dogma has a mathematical and a sacred mathematical programming to it, an alchemical programming to where it is having an effect. Reading it is having an effect on your subconscious mind. It may not be affecting your conscious mind, but think of your subconscious as a shutter on a camera. And what happens, Henrik, on a shutter on a camera? The more that you open it, slowly open it, what happens? More light comes in, right? It becomes clearer. And I believe that that's how your subconscious works in these secret societies. You go through the rituals, you go through reading this stuff, and slowly, 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 your subconscious is opened up. And gradually, the more that your subconscious is opened up, the more it's wide open eventually for total control, total mind control, total programming, and total takeover. And I think that you're exactly right. That is what these secret societies are designed to do. They are designed to open your subconscious up without you knowing it so much that you are open to control from people, from entities, from possibly extraterrestrials, pretty much anything which could have the ability to manipulate your consciousness in a way that is beyond your control. So yes, I think that's the double-edged sword of this secret information, as I mentioned earlier, is that, you know, in the hands of the people that it's in the hands of right now, in the hands of the people it's been in for thousands of years, all we can see and all we have a reference point for is the evil connotation from it. We have never been allowed to exist in a world of possibilities where this stuff could be used for a positive effect. So we, of course, everybody's going to say all of this stuff is evil and all of it is for evil purposes because that's all we've ever known. So I think you're exactly right. I think that that is definitely the, you know, beyond way before MK Ultra, way before any government mind control operations.
Yep, that's right.
The original mind control operation was the secret society and using that to manipulate consciousness.
The words that people speak, obviously implying we spell the words. It is a spell. This emanates a frequency. And then you have the intention of this. You have creation of languages, the Elizabethan that John Dee and Edward Kelly were behind of, you know, creating. There's a lot of interesting clues here. And I remember a few articles we've had up on redxcreations.com about how words also and frequencies actually program your DNA. It's a kind of a programming. These might be texts or initiatory rituals that have been left behind by someone or something else. And what if, just let's throw out a what if here, Josh. What if this is just a, if you will, then a mind control program, an advanced but ancient mind control program that kind of just have run amok, if you will, within the human society. This is, I'm not saying that it's not totally uncontrolled by anybody up at the ladder, but what if the program as such, as a meme, as a kind of a mind virus, have just taken over and these people actually have no idea in that sense what they actually are doing or implementing? That's kind of a scary thought, don't you think?
Well, no, I mean, it is a scary thought, but I think it's one that's very valid, Henry, because the idea, I think the idea of the Trojan horse in any of this stuff needs to be taken into account. How do we know that, you know, the guys who became the priests, that's what oftentimes people forget. You know, we talk about the priest class or whatever. People forget that, you know, in the days of the original civilizations going back to ancient Sumeria, you know, there wasn't congressmen and senators and lords and presidents. It was the priests. The priests were the ones who were in power. They were the ones who allegedly had the direct connection with these entities, with these gods, and then they brought back the information and gave that out to the people. I mean, how do we, as you mentioned, how do we know that everything from the very beginning of communication with these entities from, as you said, our language, how we write things out, spellings, they are spells. I mean, we don't know. It just does seem that you're exactly right. Our language is designed to basically keep us in a state of arrested development. That's one of the things, going back to, as I was talking about reading Morals and Dogma, when you read the pages of that book, Henrik, you are unable, no matter how much command you have of your particular language, you are unable to read that book and then go to someone and say, okay, this is what it's about. This is what Morals and Dogma is about. you are unable in our current language to relate what is in those texts to someone else. I think it's by design like that. Yeah, I think absolutely that all of this stuff from the very beginning has been designed to keep us in a state of arrested development. And the bottom line is that frequencies affect, you can manipulate someone's consciousness. You can manipulate someone's growth, their DNA structure, whether or not they're going to reach 12-strand DNA activation, any of this stuff, by the use and manipulation of frequencies, whether it's frequencies of sound, of the spoken word, of music, or any of this stuff. The key that I think that people are going to start to understand over the next several years is that frequencies and the manipulation of those frequencies has been one of the, if not the biggest weapon that has been unleashed on mankind for thousands of years.
That's right. And there's another point to this as well. It seems like some of these people within the circles, the elites, or entities, whatever we want to call them, are in a possessed mode. If we talk about greed, for instance, it doesn't at all explain it all the way. These are people that want more and more and more to a level where it's totally absurd. It's beyond money, and there's something else, like a religious, theological drive that is behind some of these people, it seems like. And obviously, again, we're back to that question, for what? What is the purpose? We've been talking about the invasion of certain countries to potentially get a hold of certain artifacts that are going to contribute in whatever the plan is. How far do you personally think that this extends? Josh? Are we talking about, is this even the reason why they are you know, expanding into space exploration, trying to find and discover maybe clues within our solar system of both our ancient past, but maybe also, again, going back to, you know, the Nephilim, the Watchers, the Anunnaki, what have you? What do you think of that, Josh?
I think that that's absolutely the case. I mean, I've been researching this stuff half my life, Henrik, and the conclusion I've come to personally for me, and again, you know, I want to make that crystal clear, not expecting that to be the conclusion for everybody else out there, but my conclusion for me that I've found is that that's why there's been so much importance placed on these bloodlines. That's why there's been so much importance placed on keeping their bloodlines pure and keeping those people in positions of power, is because I believe that the elite, their ultimate goal and plan is to be able to emulate and replicate what these quote unquote gods, the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, whatever you want to call them, to replicate the technology they had and master it so that they can then become gods on an equal par with those that came to Earth and mated with the daughters of man and set up society and all the rest. I think that their ultimate goal is to be able to stand side by side with those people, and in much of the same way as they probably did, take that and take their bloodlines and spread those to other planets and other galaxies throughout the universe. I think that ultimately is their plan. I think that's why they're spending trillions of dollars on things like CERN, trying to open up wormholes where they can just transport themselves from one area to another. I think that's why there's been all this importance on supercomputers. I think it was the Ames Research Center for NASA here in the United States have had multiple people dying of massive cancers on one level of this NASA Ames Research Center, where they just happened to coincidentally be working on these hyperdrive systems for interstellar travel. I everything to me seems to be going towards the achievement of technology and the harnessing of technology so that the bloodlines in power can become actual living gods and then spread that to other places. I believe that is the case.
The question here is if we can tie in the potential fake, you know, ET or alien invasion agenda as well. This might be, and this obviously is one of those situations where we, from our position, would never actually be able to know if we are, what are we looking at here? Would this be advanced human technology, the black ops, things that we never hear about that actually would come to Earth, you know, looking like this is ET? We might be talking about genetically engineered beings or even human beings to pose as the aliens. We don't know shit about this. Let's face it. We have no idea. We're totally in the dark if this would to happen, Josh.
I mean, that I see that going on right now, Henrik. I mean, they're creating cognitive dissonance all over the place, where, you know, you as well as I, every day we're looking at this stuff, and every day you see a video where a UFO video on YouTube or something gets posted, or some UFO sighting happens, and you'll see stuff sometimes where you'll go, oh, that's obviously a fake. You know, obviously that's clearly a fake. And then you see other stuff where you go, well, you know, I like these most recent videos that were shown of stuff around, Britain and around London and stuff like that. You know, some of the stuff you look at and you go, you know, is that real? Is that fake? And I think that's the whole plan, is if they want to create so much cognitive dissonance with this stuff that people don't know for sure or for certain if what they're looking at is real or fake. And so they're able to manipulate that. You know, one of the reasons that I was very on top of this whole false flag alien thing for the longest time, and I've sort of been thinking that lately that may be a much larger part of this operation. I'll tell you why. The famous quote from Dr. Wernher von Braun, ex-head of the Nazi space program, brought over to the United States after World War II during Project Paperclip. There's this common quote from Carol Rosen, his secretary.
Right.
And people in the research community often quote it and talks about, you know, first the threat would be communism, then it would be terrorism, and then it would be asteroids. And when that didn't work, it would be aliens, and they were going to stage this alien invasion. And actually, if you and listen to what Carol Rosen said, and you listen to these interviews and really hear what she says von Braun said, it's very different than that. He didn't say that they were going to stage an alien invasion and make us all believe aliens were invading us so we would put these space-based weapons up there to destroy them. He actually said that what they were going to do was they were going to tell us that these extraterrestrials that were here to help us were hostile when they were indeed not hostile. So that we would then build space-based weapons to destroy them, thus destroying any chance that they would come down and help humanity. And I started going, wait a second, that's been misquoted so many times on radio shows and movies and everything else that I can't think that it's just been a coincidence. Everyone's been mispronouncing that. So, you know, it wasn't that Von Braun actually said they're going to stage an alien invasion. He said that they were going to tell us that real aliens were actually hostile when they were not, so we would weaponize space against them and destroy them. So that's a very interesting thing to me. Yeah, again, you know, we just don't know. And I think that the one thing that people can arm themselves with to know whether or not, you know, what they see in the sky is real or isn't in the event that there's an alien invasion is this type of information. Because I think that there are going to be a lot of things that are we're going to see glaring omissions. They're going to screw up and they're going to mess up things. And I think that's going to be just like 9/11 or any other issue. Those of us who've been paying attention to this for a long time are going to be able to say, come in and say, aha, you see, you know, they messed up there. Or it, on the flip side of that, Henry, it could be that, you know, whatever happens is so right on and spot on that none of us can argue with it. I don't know. But I again, it's just very important that we all maintain the idea that anything that they tell us is real on that television is going to be an illusion.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's been a lot of strange things unfolding, obviously, in one way or another during the last few years, really, in that sense. We have strangeness in the skies over Russia. There was recently a portal of sorts spotted by an observatory in Hawaii. We had the Norway spiral, of course, and these have been, you know, explained away in different things, and it might be so. I'm putting all of these things together and realizing that something is kind of a little bit off here. We have huge sinkholes around the planet, strange weather, increased earthquakes. We had asteroids zooming by, totally missed by NASA. Now we hear stuff about Elenin. It's kind of it's a tricky time we're in right now, Josh. There's a lot of things going on, and it seems like a lot of things are being thrown at us from different angles, and everybody's kind of struggling to figure out what is going on here. How do you relate yourself to all this kind of information, Josh?
Well, I've always thought, like, for instance, this is what throws people off about when they listen to my show or they listen to my work. It throws people off because, you know, I talk about the Anunnaki stuff and I talk about the, you know, the ancient Sumerian texts and I talk about all the ancient alien stuff. But then where they lose me and where I don't jump on board with is I don't jump on board with the whole Nibiru thing. I just feel that the whole thing about Nibiru has kind of been a honeypot from the very beginning. It's been a red herring getting us to focus in on and focus in on this Nibiru thing and think that it's real while ignoring something that actually is there. And what I mean by that is there's this alleged planet called Vulcan. And when you look at these ancient Sumerian depictions of the solar system, they show our solar system and all the planets in their right order, except there's an additional two planets there. Now, people always mention that there's an additional one planet, which is, of course, Nibiru. But they never mentioned that there's this additional other planet. So when I started looking into that, I found out that it's this thing called Vulcan that's allegedly on the other side of Venus, on the other side of the sun, which we can't see. And when it comes close to the Earth, we have things like financial collapses. We have earthquakes. We have hurricanes. We have tsunamis. But because its appearance and its effects on the Earth don't coincide with the Mayan calendar and don't coincide with 2012, their effects are said to happen, you know, 2013, 14, 15, 16, people have kind of strayed against that. So I looked into the Vulcan thing, and there's not a lot about it. But last year, I was very, very taken aback by the fact that Japan sent a spacecraft to monitor Venus. And then after it was going to get done monitoring Venus, it was going to go on the other side of the sun. I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, this thing's going to go exactly where Vulcan is said to be. And then what did they call this spacecraft? It was called the Japanese Icarus spacecraft or Icarus. Hmm. And of course, in Greek mythology, you find out that Icarus was the son of Vulcan. So that to me, I started saying, okay, there's something here. There is something going on. And we've been sold this sort of this red herring of Nibiru. While meanwhile, there's something that else that's there we're not being told about that definitely does play into having effects on our planet, causing earthquakes and the rest of this stuff. But because it doesn't tie into the ability to be able to fearmonger that with 2012, I think it's been largely ignored.
So this is a body that is still tied within our solar system, kind of like a planet that is constantly out of range from our point of view.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. Very, very interesting indeed. And but this is, I mean, obviously we hear about a lot of different kinds of bodies. There's a speculation about a brown dwarf. Obviously this might be it as well. And in that sense,
that's what people believe Elnin is. Yeah.
Right. Right. So, what do you make about Elnin, by the way? Do you think that it will herald anything? Will it, you know, does it mean anything bigger? Do you think?
Yeah. You know, again, you know, it's just one of those things, Henrik. I just don't know. I will say this. At first, I didn't think that there was anything to it. I thought that it was kind of, you know, just speculation. And then one of my listeners had posted a link in my chat room to NASA's website that showed the trajectory of the comet Elnin. And I opened up this link, and it had a thing you could scroll that would show the trajectory of the comet Elnin and where it would come and how close it would come to Earth and what its trajectory was. And its exact trajectory was, it showed it going right past the Earth and slamming directly into the planet Venus. And I went, oh my goodness, you know, this could be, you know, this could have huge implications if this thing slams into Venus. I mean, this could wreak havoc in our solar system. And then that was on like Thursday or Friday. And then the following Monday, when I got ready to do my first show of the week and I went back to peruse that information again, Henrik, they had scrubbed that data off of that site and changed the trajectory of the comet Elnin, where it was no longer striking Venus. It was going perfectly between Venus and Earth. And I went, you know, that really doesn't help. The idea that people believe that this comet Elnin is something more than what they're telling us it is. And again, at that point, I was kind of skeptical. But once I saw for myself that they had, you know, literally scrubbed that data and changed its path within the matter of just a few days, I became a lot more suspicious about what this is. Again, I don't know. It's all speculation. Anybody that tells you they know for sure what it is, I wouldn't trust that. But I think that it is definitely something, Henrik. I just don't know what for sure.
Absolutely. We just have to keep on watching. And my point of view has always been, anyway, that absolutely we should look into it. We should study it. We should see if there's anything to it. If it's going to be big enough, you know, if the whole Earth is going to go under, there's nothing we can do about it anyway, actually, when you think about it. There's nothing we can try to do to make it better. We can run around like headless chickens and worry about it all day, but it's not going to solve anything in that way. And I think that, again, all of these things always ends up in that ballpark, if you know what I mean. It always ends up in the apocalyptic eschatological field, almost, that this is another doomsday, and it seems to play, if you will, a little bit on people's, I don't know what it is, a need, a desire, yeah, almost in some cases, to have this doomsday always looming around the corner. If it's not Elnin, it's 2012. If it's not that, it's the sun is going to explode or supernova or what have you. And again, all of this might be true. All of it might be happening. But I always go back to that idea. If it's so of that large, you know, magnitude, there's not much we can do about it anyway. So why worry about it, if you know what I mean, Josh?
Yeah, and it does seem, though, you know, and I think Bramley talked about that in his book, Gods of Eden, but it does seem that throughout history, it's like it's been genetically imprinted into us, this idea of an Armageddon or an apocalypse and all this stuff. And it's been constantly reinforced in culture. And it's been, you know, people have constantly believed that is, you know, that is the outcome. But I think it's just one possible outcome. And, you know, regardless of this information and how deep it is, Henrik, I'm never negative or, you know, think all hope is lost. As long as there are people like you and I out here and others that are continuing to have our minds wide open and look at our elements of this, we stand a chance. I think the biggest thing that is the hindrance to us is when, you know, as soon as we say, there's no way I'll believe that, you know, there's no way I'll believe the elite or whoever could do that. There's no way I'll believe they have this technology. As soon as you say, I could never believe that, they've got you. Mm. They've got you right there. Because once you limit your own personal scope of what you believe is possible, they can then, I mean, if you can dream it, these people have it. And at the moment when you restrict what you believe is possible, and to me, that's what the conditioning and the media and the programming and the schools and everything are about. They're about keeping our ability to perceive what is possible at a very low level. That's why we're given culture and movies and all these fantastical things and science fiction and told these are all fiction. But yet, you know, 9 times out of 10, 99% of the time, when you look at science fiction is many times based in ancient artifacts, ancient texts,
that's right.
things of that nature. So I think that's what it's been. It's been a constant program of keeping the ability of what we can perceive to be real at a very low state.
Absolutely. Many of these things are, if you will, an archetypal symbols in one sense. They represent something that seems to be a part of, in many regards, actually, the dark, you know, mysterious collective unconscious of humanity. Same thing with this doomsday anxiety. I think it's kind of there hard-coded in us in one way or another. And it's like we are fascinated by it and kind of drawn to it for various reasons, because we want to learn about it, but yet we fear it at the same time. And I think those aspects as well, you know, can be manipulated, if you will, if you don't understand that those things are there. So again, we're given movies and things like this, but at the same time, there's an incredible world out there where a lot of this stuff is and has been happening, if you know what I mean. So there's where the magic is in reality, not in the fiction, Josh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, you know, I get my paradigm blown every week, every month. I mean, I'm constantly finding new things that change what I believed the week before, the month before about this stuff. And I think that's good, because it seems to me that a lot of people, you know, I listen to some of these, you know, supposed truth or radio shows and stuff, and I hear people talking about the same thing that they were talking about 2, 3, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago in some cases, right. And there's no progression there. And I always had a real problem with that. I just always was. That's why I never wanted to be on radio or do any of this stuff, probably any more than you did, Henrik. But I just felt like I didn't have a choice, and that there was so much more information that wasn't being given a voice and wasn't being put out there that was very vital to this stuff. And I think that, I never dreamed it would lead me to uncovering the things I've uncovered now, and discovering that there is so much more to the world, to all information, to all of this, than what you will ever get if you are just following this mainstream culture of the alleged truth movement. I think it's absolutely true.
Absolutely. TheGlobalReality.com, that's your website, Josh. Radio and films for everybody out there to check out. Much more information, obviously, that Josh keeps on putting out all the time. The Secret Right, Volume 1, is out right now. And obviously, as we mentioned, you're currently working on the Volume 2. And do you have any ETA on this at all, Josh? How's it going with the second one, by the way?
Well, we had a bit of a time setback back in May, because we talked about before the show. I just had, as you know, Henrik, I had some deaths in the family, and so that kind of put me back a couple weeks. So we were actually shooting that. Originally have this out. Yeah, thank you. And we were originally shooting to have this out this month, but it's coming out sometime in August. I don't have an exact release date yet, because I'm just trying to see, but I'm really diligently trying to get it out somewhere around the 1st of August, but it will definitely be coming out in August for sure. And I'll definitely make sure you get a copy, Henrik, and able to check that out, and hopefully we can do another show again in the future. I really enjoyed it today.
Absolutely. Let's definitely have you back. There's just so much more to talk about, and I'd love to discuss more in terms of what you uncover here in the next volume of The Secret Right. And people can listen to you on Oracle Broadcasting as well. Is that right, Josh?
I'm actually not on Oracle Broadcasting anymore. I actually left that network back in 2009 and started my own network, and that's what The Global Reality is. So there at theglobalreality.com, it's also The Global Reality Radio Network. So people can hear stuff 24 hours a day on there. They can actually hear rebroadcasts of some of your shows as well on there. Henrik, I play your stuff, my stuff, and people can go there and check it out. And it's all free, and we just ask that people don't. We don't have commercials. My show is uncensored, so there's a lot of four-letter and five-letter words there. But yeah, theglobalreality.com. I don't have sponsors. I don't ask people to buy things from my website. I don't even promote my own films. I just have a chip and banner and a donate button there, and ask that if people want to support our work, they do that. But there you go. I appreciate the opportunity coming on.
Absolutely. The Global Reality with Josh Reeves. Head on over there. Check it out. And of course, if you like the material and if you want to ensure that Josh can continue his work, click on that donate button as well and help him out. We really appreciate having you on here today, Josh. It's been great, and I hope we can do it again, as we mentioned, and definitely keep me informed and updated on terms of how your work goes on Volume 2, and we'll definitely revisit that at that point.
I absolutely will, Henrik, and I just want to say again what an honor it was for me to be on here on Red Ice. I mean, you've just been doing such a fantastic job for the past 4 or 5 years with, I mean, just getting all this stuff out, the work you've done with Cesarian, and my listeners have been wanting me to come on this show for a couple of years. And so I really look forward to coming back on with you. And I'd like to maybe try and get you on my show as well, Henrik.
Absolutely. Thanks you again, Josh. Keep up the great work, and we will talk more soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our program for this time with Josh Reeves. We hope you learned something new and have some new aspects to contemplate as we continue to explore and discover new research and investigation into some of the most important topics at this time. We'll be back in just a few days with more, and we invite you to listen then. In the meantime, have a great day. Thanks to everyone at Red Ice, Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. And a special thanks to all our members out there that makes this possible. We'll be back with more before you know it. Take care.